They stood talking with the visitors, going over treatment options on compounds. Others were walking their guests over to clusters of lounge chairs and coffee tables, or for a more detailed interview behind the privacy of smoked glass partitions. The smiling staff had the clinic's tree motif embroidered onto their sleeves, the only visible emblem, save for small glowing name tags on their breasts. Now the point of view dived across the lobby, over an ornamental fish pond, then through glass doors, which swished open just in time, into a more functional area of the clinic. The view was still saturated in that soft, white radiance, but in addition to staff and patients, there were now treatment rooms, with beds and medical equipment just visible through milky partitions. The view penetrated one of these partitions. A woman sat on the edge of a bed, much as Omanier now did. There were flowers in a vase behind the woman. She wore a green gown, and was looking up at a tall, authoritative-seeming man in the same white uniform as the rest of the staff. The man was holding a compad and talking, the woman nodding, something in her expression shifting from anxiety to reassurance as his silent words washed over her. The man turned from the woman, passing his compad to a waiting attendant. Now he was looking directly at the viewer, delivering a monologue, what was obviously a sales pitch for the services on offer. Omanier stared at the face, caught between instant recognition and a sense of strange unfamiliarity. It was a handsome, boyish face, plump across the cheeks, in a way that suggested vigour and humour rather than ugliness. His hair was a mass of golden curls, rakishly tamed. His eyes were an extremely piercing, pale blue. Omanier's own eyes tracked down to the man's name tag. She read, Dr. Julius Mazarin. The man kept speaking. Then the recording broke up into static again, and the panoply evidential summary reappeared. Omanier watched the piece twice more, alert to anything she might have missed on the first playback. Then she instructed her clothes ward to provide her with her panoply uniform, and met Tang and a gathering of seniors in the tactical room. She sat in silence for several moments before speaking. "Is this the only such fragment?"
"It is, ma'am," Tang said, "that we know of.
Why didn't it come to our attention sooner?" Tang looked at Lillian Bowdry before continuing.
"We nearly overlooked it, ma'am. It was buried deep and pretty badly scrambled. We're lucky to have these 35 seconds. Whoever was running that clinic tried very hard to remove all trace of their identity, and for the most part, they succeeded."
"Can we be certain of the fragment's authenticity?"
"Why wouldn't we?" asked Bowdry. "It's as plain as day, Jane. The man in the recording is Julius Devon Garlin Voy."
"It's a close likeness, but not an exact one," Omanier said.
"That's because it would have been made decades ago when the clinic was active," Bowdry replied. "Possibly before it was fully up and running."
"We know of at least one link between the clinic and the Shell House," Clearmountain said. "We shouldn't be too surprised to find another."
"It must be investigated," said Mildred Dozzo.
"Dreyfus is already doing so," Omanier replied levelly.
"I mean, in a more direct manner, bring Garlin in again. What do you think Eng and Bankal are attempting to do, Mildred? I already have 2 prefects with orders to locate and secure Garlin."
"That's for his own protection," Lillian Bowdry answered. "Now the terms of interest have shifted. We can't escape the inevitable, Jane. Garlin is both the architect and prime beneficiary of Wildfire."
She made a distasteful puckering of her lips.
"I'm forced to admit it. Dreyfus was right all along, and we should have trusted his instincts."
He studied the other ship as it approached his own, just above the outer atmosphere of Yellowstone. It was larger than his cutter, somewhat sharper and sleeker in its lines. Whereas the cutter was almost entirely black, this new vehicle was white, except for areas of black checkering. It shone a hailing laser onto him. Dreyfus accepted the call, and a face appeared on his console. It was a woman, age indeterminate, but perhaps not far off his own. She had a tight bowl of curled hair, and a wide, freckled face, with prominent cheek and jawbones, her mouth a level, unsmiling line.
There was no trace of welcome in her eyes.
Identify yourself?
Dreyfus tried a smile. I thought I was expected.
Identify yourself? I won't ask again.
Prefect Tom Dreyfus of Panoply, requesting an interagency liaison and escort to Chasm City. I was given to understand that the Supreme Prefect had already made the necessary...
You're early?
I thought you'd appreciate it if I came and went as quickly as possible.
Then you thought wrongly.
You've caused me considerable inconvenience, Prefect Dreyfus, forcing a change in my plans at very short notice. Believe it or not, we do have work to be getting on with down here.
I don't doubt it, Dreyfus said, straining to keep a friendly and open demeanour, and I apologize for upsetting your plans. I could turn around, I suppose.
You're here now,
the woman said with a long, suffering sigh,
and my day is already ruined. We may as well make the most of it.
I'm sorry I have to take up any of your time. It's just that I'm investigating a matter which has urgent security implications. She looked unimpressed.
Your breakaway crisis? No concern of mine.
It might be about to become one.
She shook her head once. Follow my ship. We'll go in hard. Do let me know if you can't keep up.
Her face vanished from the screen. The other ship pivoted around with a flicker of steering motors, then daggered itself back towards Yellowstone, its triad of main engines flaring. In a few seconds it had dwindled to a hard, flickering glint, sliding against Yellowstone's marbled cloudscape. Dreyfus forced himself out of a sort of stunned paralysis, establishing a lock on the other ship as if he were in pursuit mode, and allowed the cutter to suspend its usual load ceilings. If she was determined to make a point, he would let her.
Your host's name is Hestia Delmar. I thought you might like to know that.
Dreyfus tried not to look ruffled or surprised. I'd have found out for myself soon enough.
But now you have one tiny edge on her. Aren't you grateful for that?
I could tell you more if you liked. Her service history, her disciplinary record, what her colleagues think of her.
A private life? Now that is interesting. We have that much in common, she and I.
Just the name is fine.
You're not cross with me, are you?
Aurora's face had superseded Hestia Delmar's, but it conveyed no more friendliness. Dreyfus rather preferred the stern-faced Delmar. At least there was no doubting her feelings.
Or is it that a troubling matter for your scruples?
The cutter held its pursuit lock on the white ship. G-loads rose, and a pinkish nimbus of ionized atmosphere began to curl around the hull, lapping and licking against its surfaces. The surfaces of Dreyfus's acceleration couch pushed through layers of skin and fat to find bones. He grunted away the discomfort like a man passing a stone.
Scruples have nothing to do with it. No. Then why were you so careful not to explain your sudden interest in Nautilus Holdings to your colleagues?
You provided a lead, Dreyfus answered, feeling sweat prickle his brow.
I looked into it. And yet no mention of where that lead came from whose lips it was shared.
Her smile was coquettish, teasing.
I'm guessing, at least. Oh, relax. I'm not privy to every single conversation you have, Prefect, much as I might like to be. It would mean I didn't have to persuade those passwords from your lips.
The cutter began to shake as dynamic forces built up. Wings and control surfaces budded from the hull, grown using rapid response quick matter, and yet they were still accelerating. Hestia Delmar was either suicidal or very, very sadistic. Possibly both. Dreyfus decided. It was a no, then. It's a no, now. We'll solve this the old-fashioned way. With police work.
Yes. Good luck with that. Have you seen the latest death forecasts? Omonier's tracking another case as we speak. Your triggers are lighting up like fireworks. If only you had those patient names, though. How much easier that would make your task.
The G-loads were reversing. Now, at last, even Hestia Delmar was having to slow down as her course took her into the deeper layers of the atmosphere. Determined not to give in, Dreyfus closed the distance between the two ships.
On the screens, her white vehicle seemed almost close enough to touch as it rammed onward through thickening yellow and brown cloud layers. Engine backwash and re-entry turbulence made for a bone-shaking pursuit. "If there's a shred of humanity left in you," Dreyfus said, grimacing out the words, "give them to me now."
"Oh, I'd love to. Really, I would. But there's the small matter of give and take. It's not often I have real leverage over you. I'd be foolish to waste this opportunity. Let go of your inhibitions."
The two ships began to level out. The hull shutters opened, the hull's visible arc still giving off a faint glow as it surrendered some of the heat gained during the entry. They were moving hypersonically now, and snatches of terrain occasionally opened up below.
"You really don't understand people any more, Aurora, if you ever did."
Her face blanched, her eyes flaring with wounded pride, a little too theatrically to be convincing.
"Hmm. You really know how to hurt a girl, Dreyfus. How unchivalrous of you. How mean."
"One day you might grow a conscience."
"Oh, I wouldn't want one of those. I tried it once, and it didn't suit me at all."
Her face began to fade out, crazing over with static before sharpening one last time.
"Regretfully, I must now take my absence. But we'll speak again, won't we?"
"No rush,"
Dreyfus said, Aurora becoming disembodied eyes and mouth, and then just the mouth, the last part of her to fade. It was gone for a moment, and then another face appeared on the console.
"Still keeping up, Dreyfus?"
"Yes, Hestia."
"Good. If you've done your homework, you'll know that my correct title is Detective Marshal Delmar. We'll keep it formal, shall we?"
"Absolutely. It's Field Prefect Dreyfus, if we're holding score."
"Follow me,"
she said.
Julius did not care for the new phase in Caleb's hunting game. He went along with it all the same, grudgingly aware that he preferred his brother's company to none at all. Caleb had grown more adept with the shaping of material objects. One afternoon, visibly pleased with himself, he showed Julius his latest triumph. It was a fully functioning crossbow, formed from a single piece of quick matter. He passed it to Julius, inviting him to admire it.
"I thought a hunting rifle was more your style,"
Julius said.
"Something that works, not just a dummy."
"I could have shaped a functioning rifle easily enough,"
Caleb replied offhandedly.
"I know what's inside a rifle.
A few moving parts. Nothing too challenging. But you need chemistry to make bullets, and quick matter's chemically inert." "Pity. Poor you."
"I figured a crossbow oughtn't to be too hard, and it wasn't. It's just a question of designing different tensile properties into the components. The range and stopping power isn't as good as a rifle, but that just makes the game a bit more interesting."
"Does it?"
"Yes. We'll need to get closer to the animals."
"They're not real,"
Julius pointed out, for all the good he knew it would do.
"They're figments. Visual ghosts. We don't need to actually shoot them with a physical object."
Caleb looked at him oddly.
"There's no fun in making the game too easy.
We have to feel as if we're doing our part, and that means we won't be able to kill them unless we're within a realistic range."
Julius sighted along the crossbow. It felt solid in his hands, well-balanced, economical and elegant in its design. It was beyond anything he was presently capable of conjuring, but Caleb already knew that, and certainly needed no further encouragement.
"As long as you don't expect us to use knives. What are we supposed to shoot with this?"
"I've already thought about that."
Caleb dug into the pocket of his shorts and came out with a sharp-tipped dart, about the size of his thumb.
"Quick matter again. I tried a few different forms until I found the right shape. Go on. Try it."
"There aren't any animals nearby.
Just shoot at anything. I want you to get the hang of it."
Julius armed the crossbow, figuring out for himself how to latch it. He placed the dart in the smooth groove that ran the length of the weapon, then raised the crossbow to his shoulder. He swung around slowly, sighting at a grove of trees about 50 paces away. He picked one tree, held his breath and squeezed the trigger stub. The bow jerked a little as it released, but he had been ready for that and it had not upset his aim. A moment later, the dart embedded itself in the tree with a solid, satisfying thunk.
I hope you've made a few more of those.
A few, Caleb said, but since it's quick matter, it responds to a homing command. He gestured in the rough direction of the tree, and the dart gave an unsettling wriggle and dropped to the ground. Julius watched as it began inching through the undergrowth, propelling itself with queasy, slug-like undulations.
I could have made it fly, I suppose,
Caleb said, but as long as it gets back eventually, it doesn't matter how long it takes. Then he patted Julius roughly.
Come on, let's go and hunt.
If it goes well, we'll talk Father into giving us some more quick matter, and then I can conjure a second crossbow just for you.
I can't wait, Julius said.
They had been walking for a few minutes, Caleb holding the crossbow again, when he said,
What did you mean back there, by the way?
About what?
Knives. You said as long as we're not expected to use knives.
Julius frowned.
Did I? I know you, Julius. And nothing comes out of your mouth by accident.
Caleb walked on, swinging the crossbow from its stock.
It's that dream of yours again, isn't it? I thought we agreed not to talk about my dream.
You were the one who raised it, not me.
I don't think I ever mentioned my dream involving knives, Caleb. I'd have remembered it if I had.
Caleb turned around, bringing the crossbow around in an arc, so that Julius had to duck back not to be bludgeoned.
Don't lie to me. You said we were standing holding knives, and everyone else was dead.
I didn't.
Julius reached up and snatched the crossbow from Caleb's grip, surprised at his own speed and strength.
I know, because I made a point of never saying it. But I've caught you out now, haven't I?
Caleb seethed, but said nothing.
We both have the same dream.
Julius carried on, meeting his brother's eyes and not flinching away from the menace he detected in them.
You just don't want to admit it. You prefer the lie you've been sold.
And what lie would that be?
That you're the son of a boy. That you're entitled to this power, this responsibility.
He threw the crossbow at Caleb's feet.
You're not one of them, and neither am I. We're something else.
He cocked his head at the shell house.
We weren't born here.
Whatever childhood we had, it wasn't the one they want us to know about. Caleb stooped down to pick up the weapon. He shook the dirt from it, tension flexing through his arm muscles.
You can keep trying to tease me, brother, but it won't work.
Either cough up or stop going on about it.
Do you remember what Dr. Stasov said the last time he was here?
I suppose you do.
He said they were making monsters out of monsters. He meant us, Caleb. He meant mother and father are trying to turn us into something. He also said we're not really theirs. Here you go again. You can pretend you don't remember, but I saw how much you were bothered by his words. If he's so clever, why haven't we seen him since? I don't know.
Julius scowled, not wanting to be sidetracked.
He was having an argument with them, wasn't he? Saying he didn't want to carry on, and they were telling him it wasn't any good. I think they were threatening him, Caleb, trying to stop him going away or whatever he was thinking of doing. It's funny that they haven't found another doctor, isn't it? I mean, there's a whole city out there. How hard could it be to find another doctor to keep an eye on two boys?
You already know we have to keep all this secret,
Caleb said.
Perhaps we don't even need a doctor now anyway. He hardly did anything the last time.
Maybe we don't need him now, but that doesn't change the things he said. He said something bad happened a long time ago, didn't he?
Well, I know what it was. They've been careful with the books they leave us, haven't they? There's not too much about the history of the Shell House or the Voy family.
No need. We get it rammed down our throats every time we walk past a painting.
Julius conceded that this was a reasonable point.
Still, I wanted to see if I could find out about something bad. And I didn't have to look very far. There's a book on Marco Ferris. It goes into a lot of stuff. I think they forgot that it also mentions the Americano settlement.
Caleb fingered the crossbow.
And? Don't pretend you don't know what I'm talking about, brother. Before they had the fast ships, they sent robots to lots of different planets,
robots with eggs inside them, or with genetic patterns that could be made into human embryos, once they'd arrived and started mining raw materials. Get to the point, Julius. In each instance, the robots created a batch of children, newborns, but there wasn't anyone around to raise those children except the robots themselves. The trouble is, the robots didn't get it right, and the children ended up all wrong. If there was a second generation, it was even worse. Something hadn't developed properly. Empathy, social awareness, call it what you will. They were little sociopaths. Little monsters.
Julius said the word deliberately, watching his brother carefully.
And most of them went mad. All those settlements, in all the different systems, they all failed for different reasons, but underlying them all was a common cause. They weren't knitting together the way human communities are meant to. No one should have been too surprised, should they? We're just mammals. That's all we've ever been, all we've known for tens of millions of years. We've evolved to grow up surrounded by other mammals, one or two generations of them, showing us how to behave. But the Americano children didn't have that. They came out of metal wombs on an alien planet, with only robots to stand in for their parents.
You're an expert, all of a sudden. Julius touched a hand to his heart.
I don't need to be. I don't need to be told this stuff, because I've known it all along. It's us, brother. That's what we are. The survivors of one of those settlements. Those are the dreams we have, being back there with the other children and the robots. That's not possible. It happened too long ago. I don't claim to understand it, Caleb, but I can't ignore it either. The Ursas. Remember them? I didn't make that up. It's all in the book. That's what the robots were called when they were trying to raise the first generation. They gave them arms and legs, like people, and covered them in fur, so they wouldn't be too frightening. It was meant to help the children, like orphans being raised by friendly teddy bears. But it all went wrong.
It wasn't us.
It was. I don't know how, but that's what happened. We killed all the other boys and girls. We weren't meant to remember it, but we do. And now we're here.
Chapter 13. It took a few moments for the mob to notice that the doors to the polling core were opening. Until that development, the human tide of Garland's assembly had seemed to be on the turn, first in ones and twos, and then in gathering numbers. Sparva had allowed himself to believe that a peaceful resolution was still feasible, and that he and Talia would be able to leave the habitat with Garland in their protective custody, and some measure of calm restored. But the opening of the doors had a profound effect on the mob's state of mind. The retreat lost its impetus, and then, with a roar of collective determination, that tidal surge began to press back towards the steps, and the seven operatives attempting to hold them. This was the crowd's moment. Those opening doors were not just an opportunity, but an invitation. The constables pressed out their stun truncheons, the ends flickering with blue sparks. The operatives with sonic cannons began to douse the crowd with continuous pulses, a horrible sound, even for anyone not caught in the direct focus of the cannons. Undeterred, the mob was already spilling onto the first couple of steps. Sparva had just enough time to bark an order to his reserve whiphound, instructing it to use maximum force in holding the line. On the level ground, next to the cleaning robot, Talia had been in the middle of persuading Garland down from his roost. Malcolmus and the other constables were next to her. The first two whiphounds were still holding a cordon, but the mob was pressing in, and he saw when Talia became aware of the opening doors. As his own whiphound zigzagged back and forth at high speed, trying to club or lash anyone who dared test its threshold, Sparva watched Talia glance around and touch her throat microphone, and then her voice sounded in his earpiece.
"Eng to Panoply. Things have just turned here. The core is compromised. Repeat, the core is compromised."
Then, locking eyes with Sparva, "Malcolmus doesn't know what's happening. Those doors shouldn't have opened."
She said there were constables inside, Sparva said. Maybe they overrode the lockdown for whatever reason. Malcolmus says no, but there should still be multiple barriers between the lobby and the core. I'm not sure I'd count on them, given what's just happened. Did Garland send any sort of signal just before the doors opened? I'm looking at him right now. He didn't say or do anything. That doesn't mean he isn't responsible. I agree, but it's nothing we can prove for the moment.
Sparva jerked back as a projectile narrowly missed his shins. Talia looked small and vulnerable, hemmed in by the mob on all sides. She had two whiphounds defending the cordon and a third at her side, but Sparva knew all too well that she could still come to harm.
You have one last chance, Garlin, he heard her call out. Tell them to pull back from the steps.
These are free citizens, he answered, roaring out his words and snarling the mob's attention while he spoke. They don't answer to anyone, Prefect Eng, let alone me. And if there has been such negligence as to leave the Corps unprotected, why should they be blamed for it? Julius, Devon, Garlin Voy, Talia said, her voice breaking under the strain. You are under arrest for the commission of actions detrimental to the democratic process.
She flicked a glance at her whiphound. Bring him down and hold him on the ground. The whiphound moved in a blur and crack of coils. Garlin had just enough time to register surprise and to begin moving his hands into a reflex defensive posture, almost a surrender. But it was to no avail. The whiphound had flung itself airborne, lassoed itself around his lower legs, drawn itself tight, and toppled Garlin. That was as much as Sparva saw clearly, but he had little difficulty imagining the rest. Garlin would have come down hard. By the time he hit the ground, the whiphound would have looped a few more coils around him for good measure, preventing him from flailing out or reaching for a weapon. Depending on the orders Talia gave, the coils would either lock solid, making it feel as if he were imprisoned in a single unyielding restraint, or would tighten under resistance, eventually biting into skin and bone.
"Have you got him?" Sparva called.
Talia grunted as she knelt down.
"Yes. Contained. Eng to Panoply. Update on the situation here. I've detained Garlin. Things are getting hot here. We could really use that backup."
The whiphound zigzag patrol was growing ever more frenetic. The citizens had gathered up their weapons again and were using them with increasing ferocity, throwing crude projectiles or swiping the air threateningly with sticks and fence posts. Individually, none of these items would have posed the slightest challenge to the whiphound, but sheer force of numbers was starting to make a difference, and Sparva knew that when the defensive line failed, it would happen quickly. He turned back to the constables.
"Fall back and regroup with your colleagues inside." "They'll overrun this entrance,"
one of the constables said, fear showing in his eyes like a bright new dawn, as if it was an entirely novel emotion.
"I'll hold it as long as I can, but if you can form a cordon around the inner core, that'll be a lot easier than defending this entrance." "How long do we have to hold it for?"
asked a second constable.
"Not long," Sparva said. "Chances are there's already a cruiser docked as we speak."
That was close to a lie. But to his relief, the constables accepted his word and abandoned their line, with one of them passing him a stun truncheon before they left. Sparva found he was surprisingly grateful for the stun truncheon. Its end was sparking, and he swung it in an arc, even as he stepped back to assume a higher position on the steps.
"Still there, Talia? Garlin and I aren't going anywhere," she said, with a sarcastic friendliness. "Are we, Devon?" "Hang tight. Don't try and move him back to the ship on your own. It's a job for two of us, even with whiphounds. Advice noted, Deputy Bunker," she said.
A second later the line fell. A hooded citizen saw their moment, springing onto the steps when the whiphound was at the opposite limit of its patrol. As the citizen crossed the threshold, another risked a swipe against the whiphound's head with the blunt end of a wooden stake, doing no harm to the whiphound, but knocking it aside, and thereby gaining a precious second or two for more citizens to swarm onto the steps. The whiphound responded with an escalation in the severity of its attacks, using the second edge to draw blood, and whipping and coiling around any limb or extremity unwise enough to stray within its range. Joints were dislocated, bones fractured, skin gashed.
Those unfortunate citizens fell back instantly, nursing sudden bright wounds, but still greater numbers came trampling forward. A few of the wounded fell to the ground, their shocked and moaning forms quickly lost under the advance. Sparva redoubled his hold on the stun truncheon. The whiphound was still flailing, still doing all that could be asked of it, but the surge of people had flowed around and past it, and the steps could no longer be defended. Sparva jabbed out with the truncheon, and citizens dropped like sacks as soon as they were touched, but there were always more. Dozens were already on the steps, oblivious to injury or the criminal nature of their actions, and hundreds pressed in from behind. He stepped back again. The shade of the lobby was at his back. Two or three citizens were already through, their shouts gaining an echoing timbre as they entered the enclosed space. More came at him. He parried with the stun truncheon, citizens dropping, the smell of burning skin and fabric ripe in his nose. Dozens were inside now, their footsteps drum-rolling into the distance as they sought the core. The stun truncheon seemed to be losing its effectiveness under this sustained discharge. They were not dropping so quickly, and in any case, the rush of citizens was beginning to overwhelm him, their combined momentum causing him to be pushed back, carried along on their seething front. Finally, someone wrenched the truncheon from his two-fingered grip, and an elbow smashed into his face. Sparva blacked out. Dreyfus buckled on his equipment and made his exit from the cutter. His belt felt tight under his belly, as if his guts had shifted during the re-entry. Hestia Delmar was already striding around on the landing pad, wrinkling her nose as she sniffed at the fumes still lingering under the pad's pressure-tight ceiling. She wore a white uniform with crisp black trim at the cuffs and collar, and carried no weapons or enforcement devices that he could make out. "Did you push it a little harder than was wise, Field Prefect Dreyfus?" Dreyfus shrugged. "I kept up, didn't I?" She looked doubtful. "I'd get that cladding looked at if I were you." "I'll make a note of it," Dreyfus said, looking up into her face. "Look, Hestia, wouldn't it be easier if we just put our professional differences aside for a few hours? I'm sure we'd turn out to have a lot in common." "My name's Tom. I know your name." She started walking away from the two ships, down a shallow ramp. "As you know mine. But I believe in the professional courtesies, Prefect Dreyfus. I feel it helps to have a clear sense of responsibilities. We'll take my flyer the rest of the way. You have flyers in the glitter band, don't you?"
"And fire? And the wheel?" Dreyfus said.
At the base of the ramp stood a sleek black flying machine, shaped like a cat's paw. Delmar beckoned for Dreyfus to climb into the volunteer's cabin and buckle into one of the padded seats. Then she joined him and folded down the vehicle's aerodynamic canopy, taking a seat next to his own. Delmar muttered something into her collar, and the volunteer took off and sped into a narrow, rock-lined tunnel.
"Before we get to the shell house," Delmar said, "you should be aware that we take a very dim view of attempts to influence democratic process in the Glitter Band, however much the outcome might not be to your liking."
"And if I told you that my interest in the shell house is only incidental to the breakaway movement, would that change your mind?"
"You would need to persuade me first, Prefect Dreyfus."
Rock walls hurtled by at great speed. Dreyfus's back was sticky with sweat, forming too quickly to be absorbed by his clothing. He leaned forward, unpeeling himself from the seat.
"We have a developing emergency involving random deaths. If your intelligence on us is as good as ours on you, then you'll already know of it."
"I don't need intelligence. I just need to listen to the rumors."
"You're right. It's already out there, and it'll soon be beyond our ability to contain. But you must understand why we've tried to keep a lid on it.
And the relevance of, you call it wildfire, the relevance of all this to the shell house?"
"The dead seem to have had some contact with a private medical facility in the Glitter Band, a clinic calling itself Elysium Heights. We think the money behind the clinic originated with the shell house." She listened and nodded, and for the first time he had the impression he was being treated, if not as an equal, then not with complete contempt.
"It could be an attempt to damage the standing of Devon Carlin by linking him to your crisis."
"I've still got to look into the connection. Devon Carlin can hang himself for all I care.
It's the wildfire deaths that I'm here to stop. By identifying past clients of this clinic? That's our hope. We have a lead that suggests about 2,000 clients in total. But we're nowhere near identifying unique individuals, let alone figuring out their present whereabouts. 2,000 is rather a lot of people, Prefect. You can't even be sure that all of these individuals still live in the Glitterband. There'd have been nothing to stop some of them emigrating to Yellowstone. In which case, you might have seen a few wildfire cases of your own by now, Dreyfus said. Which we'd know if you had.
Would you?
Of course. You'd have shared that intelligence with us.
Well, naturally. But first, we'd have to be sure of what we were dealing with. If, say, we were interested in the prior whereabouts of three individuals who had become of concern to us, and we asked for Panoply's assistance with this matter.
Dreyfus blinked against a sudden inrush of daylight as the Voluntor exited the tunnel into clear air. Mountain-sized buildings slipped by on either side. Did you make such a request?
You know that we did.
I don't, and I'd have pushed for cooperation if I did.
Then it's a pity you aren't in a higher position of authority. Our request was roundly ignored.
Dreyfus made the mistake of looking out and down. The building's roots seemed to plunge an impossible distance, with tiered gardens and lakes reduced to tiny swatches of colour. No matter how far down he peered, he could see nothing that looked like ground level or bedrock. Vertigo had him slumping into his seat. I can't believe that Jane O'Monier would dismiss a lead relating to wildfire.
We didn't mention wildfire. All we asked was that Panoply assist us in backtracking the movements of these individuals,
with, presumably, a cover story to explain your interest.
It was stated that they were fugitives. It was only a slight untruth. All three had had some involvement in semi-legal activity prior to their deaths. They had evaded justice. They had been fugitives in a technical sense.
If that's your idea of a slight untruth. But Dreyfus relented, knowing he needed to keep his host cooperative, at least for the next 13 hours. Knowing what you do now, would you describe them as risk-takers?
Conceivably. Why would you make that connection?
Because it shows up time and again in our wildfire cases. Hedonism, pleasure-seeking, recklessly addictive behaviour, call it what you will. It's the only pattern that was there from the start.
And the significance of this pattern?
I don't know yet. But something happened to our victims in that clinic. They were treated for something, presumably voluntarily, and years later their heads explode. I'd have put it down to some unlikely side effect, except that it worked so well for Devon Garland.
I see that it puts you in a bind.
Something tightened in her face, almost a grimace of sympathy, if Dreyfus read her correctly.
You're of the opinion that Garland engineered wildfire as a boost to his separatist movement?
I'd have counted it as unlikely, until that link to the shell house came up.
And now you hope to confirm your suspicions with some old-fashioned boots-on-the-ground police work. I'm afraid you may be in for something of a disappointment, Prefect.
She turned to glance out the window, the tendons showing in her neck.
There was a man making outlandish claims, an embittered former employee. His story was preposterous, but I looked into it anyway, and that meant I had to visit the Shell House.
What man?
You miss my point. I went there. It's a crumbling, overgrown ruin, and it's been that way for decades. There's nothing there.
The blood was still running from his nose when he came around, slumped with his back against the wall, the whip-hound waiting next to him, loyally alert to his movements. He was in the lobby, exactly where he had fallen, citizens streaming through the open doorway, completely uninterested in him. Sparva reached out to the whip-hound, using it for leverage as he regained his footing. Still groggy, he clipped the retracted whip-hound to his belt and staggered along the wall until he reached the doorway. Something had twisted in his knee when he went down, and each footfall sent a precise stiletto of pain jabbing up his thigh. The area in front of the polling corps building was a littered and smoking mess,
but there could not have been more than 100 citizens still out there. Some of them were fighting each other. There were bodies on the ground and fires stretching away, beacons proclaiming some total breakdown of civil order. The majority of Garland's mob, without doubt, had gone inside. He straightened up as best he could, wiped a sleeve under his nose to soak up the blood, and watched as the blood faded back into the stainless black fabric.
"This is Prefect Bancal," he said, opening a channel to Panoply. "Request expedited backup. The mob has overrun the polling corps building. Eng and I couldn't hold them back. If they break through to the corps itself, we may lose abstraction and comms services."
He paused, smearing his nose again.
"Panoply, this is Prefect Bancal."
He trailed off, because he had seen something. A single whiphound was defining an exclusion cordon around a curious hump-backed form on the ground, next to the toppled-over cleaning servitor. A second whiphound, outside the cordon, twitched and coiled in a single spot on the ground, like a snake with a severed head. Of the third whiphound, nothing was to be seen. Sparva limped down the steps. A handful of constables were still trying to impose calm, but as soon as they pacified one group of citizens, a fight broke out elsewhere. Several were kneeling by the fallen and injured. He hobbled to the cordon around the humped form. The circling whiphound detected his authority and allowed him to step into the area. He moved to the shape on the ground. It was Talia, pressed down over Garland, with her back to the sky. He immediately understood that she'd used her own body to protect Garland, shielding him from any possible advance of the mob. He watched her guardedly, wondering why she had not pulled herself off Garland, now that the time of greatest danger had passed.
"Talia?"
he said. She neither moved nor responded. Sparva mouthed an oath, realizing that she must be injured or incapacitated. He knelt down next to her, praying for an obvious sign of life. A ragged voice called to him. He turned. It was Malthmus, looking as if she had just been through a military campaign. Dirt was sweat plastered to her face. One eyelid was swollen. She stood at the cordon's edge.
"Prefect, will it let me through?"
Sparva nodded, even as he reached out a hand to touch Talia. Malcolmus hesitated for an instant, then took him at his word, stepping across the line grooved into the dirt by the hurtling whiphound. She joined him next to Talia.
"Is she all right? I don't know."
He studied her carefully.
"I think she's breathing. What the hell happened out here?" "They came in fast,"
Malthmus said, catching her breath.
"Started picking at the edge of Garland's crowd. I tried to call in more constables, but I couldn't get a signal through."
"You won't," Sparva said. "They've taken out the corps. Everything rides on that. Even our own comms back to Panoply.
But my constables inside the building. The lockdown shields. None of it worked. The corps was wide open from the moment those doors opened." "That isn't how it's meant to happen."
"Story of our lives." He had tugged up her sleeve enough to feel for a pulse, and believed he could feel one, albeit weakly.
"Can you help me with Talia?" "Yes. Yes, of course."
Together, with great care, they lifted her off Garland's form and laid her down on her side. Her uniform had stiffened across her back, forming a defensive shield from her neck to her hips, hard as a turtle shell.
"She can't be too badly hurt, can she?"
Malcolmus asked, touching a finger to Talia's lidded eyes.
"I don't know. How well do you think you'd feel if a mob had just trampled over you?" "I didn't mean..."
"It's all right," Sparva said, not wanting to have snapped.
"I know you see two prefects, two of us in uniform, coming to teach you how to run things, but that's not how it was. Talia's my friend." "I understand,"
Malcolmus said. Sparva wanted to do something, but he knew that there was little he could offer that was not already being handled by the medical systems embedded in Talia's uniform. It would be sampling her blood chemistry, administering micro-dosages of tailored drugs, doing all it could to stabilize her condition before help arrived. Malcolmus left, then came back with an item of clothing that had been left on the ground. Gingerly, she slipped it under Talia's head, so her face wasn't in the dirt.
"Thank you,"
Sparva said.
"I didn't see much of what happened. I think they ran right over her. Even with those whiphounds,
and then, when the others piled in, all they wanted to do was tear him apart.
She wasn't kidding about taking him into protective custody,
Sparva said, shifting her body so she might be able to breathe more easily.
He's alive, I think,
Malkmus said.
Good. I'd hate to miss the look on his face when he finds out who saved his life.
Yes, she said, half a smile creasing into her dirt-smeared face.
I wouldn't mind being there for that myself.
Sparva unclipped his whiphound, ran a medical scan on Prefect Eng and Julius Devon Garland Voy, coordinate with all remaining whiphounds, and continue attempting to signal Panoply that we need a heavy medical squad inbound at maximum priority.
How long will it be?
They'll have gone to an emergency posture as soon as the core went down, but I don't know how long it will take. Maybe an hour.
Less, if we're lucky.
Malkmus stood up, her hand on her stun truncheon. She looked around at the chaos and smoke, the slumped bodies and the brawls still continuing.
Does it look like it's our lucky day?
I'm going to see if I can reach some of our own medical functionaries.
You'll be safer in this cordon. Call in the rest of your constables before they get too bruised and bloodied out there.
You took a few bruises for us today, Prefect. The least we can do is take our share. Sparva spoke to the still-circling whiphound.
Break cordon and provide protective escort to Chief Constable Glenda Malkmus. Accept orders from Glenda Malkmus under discretionary limits.
She looked at the whiphound with unconcealed apprehension.
What about you?
I'll be fine, Sparva said.
This one will shield us once it's run the medical scans. The other whiphound will stay with you until you dismiss it.
I shouldn't be long.
Take care out there, Constable Malkmus.
I almost forgot to ask.
Are you going to be all right, Prefect?
Oh, I'm right as rain.
Sparva looked down at his fallen colleague, resting a hand on her side, feeling her breathing, shallow but steady.
Like I said, just one big fun day out.
Garlin had come around by the time Panoply's reinforcements reached the habitat. By then, Malkmus had returned with as many constables as she could mop up, as well as four fatigued-looking medical functionaries. They tended Talia, treating her with a sort of wary reverence, as if Sparva might hold them accountable for any lapses. But he had complete faith in them, as he did in the heavy medicals who arrived shortly after, accompanied by 20 field prefects with dual whiphounds. They made a formidable presence, but Sparva was not a little surprised to see they were still carrying no weapons beyond the whiphounds. Given the severity of the declining situation in Fuchsin-Nimburg, he had expected the Supreme Prefect to petition for the use of the heavy weapons still stored in Panoply's vaults, ready to be released to the prefects for a period of exactly 130 hours. Either the petition had failed, or Lady Jane had decided the stakes were still not quite high enough to justify that measure. Under the moderate restraint binding that Sparva had applied from his belt, Garlin moaned his way into semi-alertness.
"Get this stuff off me."
"Did you not hear my colleague placing you under arrest?"
Sparva asked reasonably, "and then placing her own life on the line to protect you, when the tempers you'd stirred up turned against you?" One of the newly arrived prefects knelt down next to them.
"Prefect Bancal, good to see you, sir. We understand Garland's been served a detention order."
"Talia Eng did it just before the mob closed in," Sparva said.
"Have you got word back to Panoply?"
"Just now, sir. Partial restoration of core. The constable sealed the doors from the outside and pumped sleeping gas into the building. It took down a few of their own, but they'll make a good recovery, and it allowed the rest of them to go in and consolidate the core. Our technicians are down there arranging a full restart. No one's quite sure why the lockdown failed, though."
"Perhaps Mr. Garlin can shed some light on that," Sparva said.
"Panoply say to bring him in on the arrest order. We can take over from now, if you like."
"No,"
Sparva said, fighting to his feet and dragging Garlin halfway to standing in the process.
"Mr. Garlin and I will be just fine on our own."
Dreyfus was getting the hurry-up-and-wait treatment. They had stopped off at the offices of the Chamber for City Security, Hestia Delmar going off to deal with some doubtless urgent administrative business, even though it was on his time, eating into his allotted 13 hours. He accepted it stoically, gazing out of a window in an empty meeting room, conscious that Panoply probably put some of its own visitors through a similar process.
Beyond the glass, Chasm City stretched away to the limits of vision, building after building receding into a twinkling, pearly haze. It was the densest urban concentration in human history, vastly larger and more populous than any of the habitats under his responsibility. The size of the place made the back of his neck tingle with a sort of anti-claustrophobia, his innate understanding of the right and proper scale of things constantly mocked and undermined in every direction that he stared. Habitats were contained, manageable. Their cities never had room to sprawl too far before meeting their own edges again. Even if the worst possible thing went wrong in a habitat, it was still just one among 10,000. But this place was madness. It was a huge, humming human machine, spun up to berserk speed, just waiting to go wrong. He thought of Devon Garlin being born here, the son of one of the oldest, most influential and respected families, given the metaphorical keys to this city, all its promise and power at his fingertips. And still that wasn't enough for you, you bastard. His bracelet chimed. Dreyfus, he said.
It's Jane, he heard. I gather you've arrived. Are you making progress?
They're falling over themselves to help, Dreyfus said.
Good.
Good? I was being sarcastic.
Fine. Yes.
He picked up on the distracted edge in her voice.
I should have... Look, something's happened, and I feel you should know about it.
To do with Garlin.
Eng and Bankol got caught up in trouble in Fuchs in Nimberg. Garlin was in danger of being trampled, and Eng took him into protective custody. But she got hurt in the process.
Hurt?
She made a human shield of herself. When Bankol made it back to her, she was unconscious.
Dreyfus sifted through his emotions. Pride that Eng had acquitted herself selflessly. Resentment that he had not been allowed to be there in her place, with all his additional years of experience. Anger that Sparva had not done a better job of looking over her shoulder. Why the hell wasn't he with her to begin with?
Don't blame him. If anyone's at fault, it's me, for not sending in a larger team.
Dreyfus made an effort to lower his voice. Where is Talia now?
Under observation, being transported back to Panoply. They tell me she's stable, but I daren't count my blessings yet.
We'll throw the entire resources of the medical section at her when she comes in, but until then we can only hope for the best.
It was a mess, Tom. Worse than I anticipated.
Garland's mob gained access to the polling corps.
That's impossible.
It happened.
And you've been the one telling me all along that Garlin wasn't operating within the usual rules.
I was hoping to be proved wrong, not right.
Too late for that, I'm afraid. We have Garlin, at least. Barring a few bruises, he got off lightly.
At least you have reasonable grounds to detain and question him now.
More than that. Something came in after you left. A definite link between Garlin and the clinic.
It was definite enough, as far as I was concerned.
The rest of us needed a little more persuasion. Now we know Garlin was posing as Dr. Julius Mazarin, one of the clinic's staff.
He confessed to it, did he?
No. He's still putting up a facade of ignorance about the whole thing.
What we have is a video fragment. Send it through to my goggles when you have a chance. But I'm not pinning all our hopes on fragments. No citizen quorum will sign off on an enforcement action on the basis of a video, no matter how incriminating.
We'll squeeze Garlin. He may crack any moment. In the meantime, continue your investigation of the Shell House.
Dreyfus glanced over his shoulder. Just as soon as Hestia Delmar finishes off her year-end tax returns, or whatever else is keeping her.
I'm sure she's a busy woman. Oh, and Tom?
Yes?
Another wildfire case just came in. Make that our 63rd victim.
66th, Dreyfus corrected her. I just learned about 3 earlier cases.
That doesn't match... Oh, wait, I see.
Obvious in hindsight, I suppose, that Wildfire would show up on her watch as well as mine. I believe you had a request for intelligence sharing. Something about tracking down fugitives.
Yes. I put Jermal onto it.
I couldn't give her authorization to use all available resources, though. Especially not now. I just trusted that... The problem would go away if we ignored it long enough.
That's a little unfair. Jirmal understood the request had to be treated with a realistic level of priority. Not ignored, not at all, but relegated until we're out of this mess.
We're not the only ones who could use a helping hand occasionally, Jane. We should have been more cooperative from the outset. I'm trying to rebuild some bridges now, although judging by Hestia's warm and welcoming nature, it might be a bit too late. Anyway, I've told her what we know about wildfire, as little as it is.
She doesn't have pangolin clearance.
I'm aware of that, but just for once I felt a little trust might not go amiss.
All right, she said with grudging agreement. It's risky and I'll probably regret it, but share with her as you see fit. And use your damned discretion, too. She doesn't have to know everything. In the meantime, I'll attempt to make amends about her requests. You'll have that feed on your goggles as soon as Tang sends it through.
Thank you, Jane. Keep me informed about Talia, will you?
I will.
There was a cough from behind him as he signed off. He turned around to see Hestia Delmar placing some items on the room's bare table. I was starting to worry you'd forgotten about me, Dreyfus said.
It took a little longer than I anticipated to compile these summaries, Delmar answered, squaring up the little pile of dossiers she had created. These are evidential packages relating to our three wildfire cases. There are issues of witness confidentiality, so I had to make sure we weren't in violation of our own rules, which meant omitting some of the testimonies. I also had to go up the chain of rank to get agreement, and not all my superiors were happy with the idea of sharing this knowledge in the light of Panoply's recent intransigence.
All right. Dreyfus was momentarily flummoxed.
Thank you. Just as long as you didn't think I was wasting your very precious time, Prefect.
She gave him a knowing look. You may take these dossiers and examine them as you see fit. In the meantime, the contents will be uplinked to Panoply for the eyes of Jane Aumarnier and her tactical staff only. I did you a disservice, Dreyfus said, reaching for the dossiers. I assumed...
Later,
Delmar said, flicking aside his apology with the disdain it merited. She had parked the Volantor on the roof. They returned to it, climbed in, then swooped off and dived hard. Delmar had given the Volantor a verbal instruction before, but now she was flying it on manual override, making effortless but precise inputs via its multi-mode joystick. Layer after layer of Chasm City rose up and stacked into a thickening, grid-like pattern overhead. The gold-stained daylight, which had seemed bright from the train, now turned brassy, then sepia, then a dim, effectless brown. Still, the building's roots plunged deeper. Concourses, shopping plazas, parks, woods, gardens, civic lakes rose up and were swept into the dense complication overhead.
So about your call from Panoply?
Dreyfus affected no surprise that he had been eavesdropped on. What about it?
Firstly, the obligatory sympathies concerning your injured colleague. I trust she makes a good recovery.
So do I.
After a silence, Delmar said, How could Garland's people get into the polling core so easily? Didn't you have the place under some sort of lockdown?
It failed. We don't know why.
Yet your boss made mention of Garlin operating beyond the usual rules.
Dreyfus sighed, debating with himself how candid he ought to be. It was one thing to share scraps of intelligence, another to voice unverified theories of his own. I've been keeping an eye on him since he crawled out of the slime. There are things he can do, things he's able to find out that can't be easily explained. Call them superhuman powers of omniscience and foresight. He caught her sidelong expression, doubt shading into incredulity. Nothing magical. I just think he's able to use abstraction in a way that shouldn't be possible. He can pick up on information patterns, detecting my presence in a crowd, for instance. But it goes beyond that. I think he just willed that lockdown to collapse. I'm not even sure he knows how he does it.
And do you have an explanation for these capabilities?
He's a boy. I think Devon Garlin must have been let in on a few family secrets.
But to be so brazen about it, he must expect to be found out.
He's careful. There's always an alternative explanation. If he spreads rumours about wildfire, it's only because he picked up on the gossip himself. If I bump into him, it's just coincidence. But over time, the pattern becomes clear. Gradually, the last traces of daylight vanished, and the only lighting sources were the artificial colors of neon signs, the busy, strident flickering of holographic